A sixth round of TTIP negotiations concludes in Brussels. A new draft law in the US aims to cover your accounts as digital assets. The European Commission addresses an open letter critical of its Human Brain project. And the final in a three-part series on the role of privacy in a changing world. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40ANM in 5, the weekly download of 40ANM LLC. It's Monday, July 28th, and I'm Chris Boehm. First up, on July 18th in Brussels, EU and US officials ended what was their sixth round of negotiations toward a transatlantic trade and investment partnership, or TTIP as it's called. Regulatory cooperation between respective regulators on areas including standards and conformity of assessment was a key component of the discussions. Although the parties report having consolidated the text in five areas, they are negotiating over nine sectors, including pharmaceuticals, cards, chemicals, and engineering. The EU and US negotiators also reported bringing positions closer together on what has been the often contentious issue of state-to-state dispute settlement. The sixth round of talks had kicked off on Monday, July 14th, and if successful, the TTIP would cover more than 40% of global gross domestic product and account for large shares of world trade and foreign direct investment. The trade relationship between the EU and US is already the largest in the world, with trade in goods and services worth roughly $2 billion. Each side has its sensitivities, according to US Ambassador to the EU Anthony Gardner, in an interview made last week with Euractiv. He added that the US has been particularly clear regarding its view on financial services, saying that energies would be better spent making progress in areas which are on the table. The US has excluded financial services from the negotiations, and the Euractiv article speculated whether the EU was, in part perhaps, paying the price for similarly having insisted to keep the audiovisual sector off the negotiating table. Both sides noted that a highlight of the negotiating week was the opportunity to engage intensively with over 400 representatives of civil society, from consumers to environmental NGOs, from trade unions to public health representatives, and with industry. A few areas received particular emphasis in these side engagements. One of these is the perceived unnecessary duplication of regulatory requirements that can ostensibly prevent small and medium-sized enterprises from doing business across the Atlantic. Some examples mentioned include the complexity of customs procedures, duplication of inspections of manufacturing facilities, and the duplication of certain certification requirements. This past week, the Washington Post and National Public Radio's Molly Roberts were among a select few to note the drafting of the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, a model law created by the Uniform Law Commission, which would let relatives access the media accounts of the deceased. You would think that such access would be easy. If a father, son, or spouse were to pass, children or next of kin would have access to their accounts, sometimes facilitated by an executor of an estate, of course, much like you'd have access to the diary or letters of your loved one. In the offline world, this access to nearly identical writings, relationships, and pictures is expected. Not so in the online world, where, as Molly Roberts points out, many social media and internet terms of service are strict on this point. Only the user can access his or her account. Facebook, for instance, as NPR points out, will switch user profiles to memorial status if a decedent's family asks, but the site does not allow family members to log into a loved one's page without a formal request, and sometimes these are turned down. NPR goes on to describe two families, one in Virginia, another in Minnesota, who were both frustrated in attempts to perhaps learn more or gain closure through access after their son's untimely deaths. The aim of the Uniform Law Commission, a national organization of attorneys, is to help standardize laws across the country by recommending legislation for states to adopt. The ULC's proposed law in this case would override terms of service provisions that would otherwise prevent families from accessing deceased user accounts and content, rendering such access to such materials no different than they would be in the offline world. The concept of media neutrality in application here is nothing new. Your executor and designees or next of kin would have access regardless of whether the material is on paper or on a website. Some disagree, though. As Carl Sabo, policy counsel for the trade association NetChoice eCommerce, told NPR, the ULC law could threaten the privacy of the deceased by setting the default privacy to zero. Jim Halpert, attorney in DLA Piper in the U.S., also believes that it could hurt, telling NPR that the draft takes no account of minimizing intrusions into the privacy of third parties who communicated with the deceased, doctors, psychiatrists, and clergy, for example. But in setting the privacy default to zero for purposes of an estate and next of kin, unless the person makes affirmative choice for greater privacy in life, is in fact the norm. It is the reason, for instance, why some privacy-conscious public figures of our past burn letters and correspondence, or had their wills attest to universities or other institutions holding private papers for study after many years had passed. And as for doctors, lawyers, and the like, the rules of privacy between doctor and patient or lawyer and client exist for the individual, not for the practitioner. Some companies like Yahoo are letting users choose. Yahoo's ending platform in Japan, for instance, facilitates farewell emails, cancellation of services, and choice of photos or videos for deletion. Planning like this is, of course, very cultural in Japan. And interestingly, as the Washington Post pointed out this past week, the word shukatsu not only means end-of-life preparation, but also job search in Japanese. Fortunately, my career service counselors, the ones that we had in law school, didn't find this bit of Japanese worth mentioning in our first-year seminars. As I look at my grandfather's diary today, there is no provision made for the details he brought to light of medical visits and consultation with his Presbyterian minister. In the absence of further instruction, my own sense of propriety dictates discretion, and I hope today that he would think I was taught well. The Telecommunications Privacy Act, or TCPA, is the federal law that many rely on for relief from not only endless potential cold calling from businesses and other groups dialing your home at all hours of the day, but also from fax advertisements, those annoying one-sheet-plus ads that would pop up on fax machines announcing deals on cruise vacations or the like, often littering office copy rooms throughout the 90s and early 2000s. Andrew Hoffman of the Information Law Group noted last week that there is a new law in town, or at least one to be aware of in Connecticut, a so-called mini-TICPA, that may regulate even more conduct than the federal rules. According to Mr. Hoffman, this mini-TICPA goes into effect on October 1, and the language covers text messages, which are already covered by the federal rules, but it also is much broader, potentially covering in-app messages sent to a mobile phone via the internet. Where the act really seems to differ from the federal rules, according to the Information Law Group summary, is in the fact that it provides for reasonable attorney's fees unavailable under the federal rules, which may provide incentive for plaintiffs' attorneys to initiate more litigation, particularly in smaller suits. Unlike the federal rules, the new Connecticut mini-TICPA doesn't provide for statutory damages, so according to Mr. Hoffman, plaintiffs may face some difficulty in showing the actual damages required under the new rules. In some ways, the federal rules still remain stronger for individuals. For instance, the Connecticut law will provide exemption in some cases for calls or texts to an existing customer or in connection with an existing debtor contract. But the existing customer or established relationship defense is no longer possible under the federal rules. However, at least in Connecticut, the prospect of two sets of rules will give plaintiffs choice, and in this case, a broad spectrum of avenues under the law. Twenty people met in London last week, the first meeting of a coordination group that will be responsible for preparing a transition proposal for what's known as the IANA functions. When the U.S. Department of Commerce's NTIA announced on March 14th its intent to transition key internet domain name functions to the global multi-stakeholder community, it set in motion a process toward development of a transition proposal, milestones and timelines for the globalization of the IANA functions. These functions, the contract that underlies them, and the domain name system that they support are critical to the administration's stability and security of the internet. How they are transitioned is arguably the most important question to face the internet governance space since the Clinton administration tapped leaders of the internet in 1998 to create the nonprofit ICANN to run the internet in a more global and democratic way. In the wake of the London meeting this past month, and in anticipation of the Internet Governance Forum to take place in Istanbul from September 2nd through the 5th, several leaders in the Internet community have commented not only on these critical events, but also on the importance of participation in the multi-stakeholder process that makes up governance of the Internet. The Business Insider reported in a piece last week, Rob Atkinson's note that the U.S. decision was due, or at least in part, to political pressure on the White House, thanks to the NSA spying scandal. Rob Atkinson is president of the think tank, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, or ITIF. Although the leaders of the global internet community have noted that the NSA revelations may have speeded up the decisions for the U.S. to essentially get out of the internet bodyguard business, as the Business Insider put it, most would agree that the U.S.'s oversight role of ICANN, however hands-off it has been in practice, is a distinct issue that has been in the crosshairs of the global multi-stakeholder community long before June 5th of last year. For NTIA's part, its leader, Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Communications and Information, Larry Strickling, spoke on July 22nd to the American Enterprise Institute, emphasizing that although the IANA functions themselves are critical, the transition process will not fundamentally change the Internet for anyone, adding that the response from the global Internet community has been overwhelmingly supportive, and that the community is taking this transition very seriously and is committed to develop a transition plan. Referring to the consultative process that was kicked off with the London meetings, Mr. Strickling emphasized that before any transition takes place, the business, civil society, and technical experts of the global internet community must prepare a consensus plan that ensures the uninterrupted and stable functioning of the internet. To that end, he played down any fears that by ceding its supervisory authority, a role maintained by the NTIA, the internet might be in danger of becoming captive to any government influence. Vince Cerf, long known as Father of the Internet, agrees, emphasizing that the U.S. isn't giving away its authority and evil superpowers aren't taking over in response. Cerf's message, in a now viral video on YouTube that he produced as Google's chief internet evangelist, attempts to put the IANA transition in context, and his video entitled Vince Cerf Explains runs about 3 minutes and expertly underscores the context of the current transition in a way that should be accessible to even the most non-technical internet users. Steve Del Bianco, executive director at NetChoice, wrote a blog on July 8th at Circle ID that not only underscores the importance of engaging a wide body of stakeholders in this process, but also pointedly makes the pitch for interested parties to simply get involved, participate actively, come to the table, and take up the virtual pen to improve policies and principles. The European Commission's Robert Madelin responded last week to an open letter, as reported on by the BBC's Jonathan Webb, criticizing the European Commission's billion-euro human brain project. Robert Madelin is the Director General for the Commission's Directorate on Communication Networks, Content and Technology, or DG Connect. The open letter contained over 200 signatures, including from many cognitive neuroscientists, complaining that the Commission's human brain project concentrates too exclusively on simulations of the human brain, rejecting the top-down function-based analysis at the heart of much brain study in the field of neuroscience. The project instead focuses on bottom-up cell and network modeling, which may be a reason why the project functionality sits in DG Connect. As part of a review of the project's framework partnership agreement, which the BBC cites is a necessary hurdle for the project to unlock continued funding, the European Commission suggests that there will be recommendations on the balance between the core project on the human brain and a number of partnering projects, presumably including cognitive work, according to the BBC. Mr. Madelin's response to the open letter cited that there is no single roadmap for understanding the human brain, and although he added that the exact scope of the project is a matter for the project itself, he noted that the review being conducted by independent and high-level experts, due in September, should address the governance of the overall initiative. In October, the International Bar Association will publish a book tentatively entitled Key Issues in Communications, Media, and Telecom Sectors, in conjunction with their annual conference to take place this year in Tokyo. I'm proud to have an article entitled The Role of Privacy in a Changing World to be included in that publication. Last week and the week prior, I presented parts 1 and 2 in a series of 3, giving an abbreviated sneak peek of this article, which I hope will spur your interest in the publication, the work of the bar in this area, and the many excellent authors taking part. Last week's segment focused on the question, has law bridged the gap, assuming that we know what the gap is? This week, the sea change in the role of trust, and where do we go from here? When I wrote in January 2013 that the EU-US privacy relationship had several fundamental stumbling blocks despite many mutual goals, I did not expect that investigative measures would be the one stumbling block to soon dominate the news. From former NSA contractor Edward Snowden's first notices of a bulk telephone metadata database to more recent revelations, the breadth of surreptitiously collected information, most of it swept up and warehoused without a trigger of investigative purpose, is staggering. For a time after June 5th, I tried to see things from the perspective of some in Congress who, despite the waves of revelations, seemed conflicted with regard to what should be done. We don't see the oppression of a virtual invasion of privacy very much, and you cannot hold up a picture of someone being electronically spied on. Even worse, you cannot immediately illustrate the psychic damage and cowed sensibilities that come with the fear of being spied on. And to attempt a clinical observation of the long-term effects of surveillance or social manipulation would be morally repugnant, rendering the subject little more than a human toy. In reality, of course, none of us who have ever been remotely engaged on the issues of security and privacy had until June 5, 2013, been living in a state of blissful naivety. Many of us assumed that in some way, shape, or form, we were being surveilled for purposes of national security. The issue, though, is the degree to which the need for intelligence have, since 9/11, progressively weighed far more heavily in the balance with privacy and civil rights. For better or worse, I spent a greater part of the 9 months after June 5th writing, speaking, and providing commentary on issues relating to the surveillance revelations. My analysis of the legal issues is best left to other texts, particularly a speech I gave at the International Bar Association conference in Boston in October 2013. Suffice it to say that the same many of us who presumed some measure of surveillance as a necessity also assumed that there would be far greater limits, audits to show justifications, and oversight. We need only look to 2 reports issued in December 2013 and January 2014 from the President's Review Group on Intelligence Communication Technologies and the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, respectively, to know that we were wrong. For instance, the PCLOB determined that the mass surveillance program was not only ineffective, but also had no basis in law. It also found that the program had never stopped even a single imminent terrorist attack. For the many millions in resources that have been spent on collecting at all and developing technologies to parse the minutiae of so many daily lives, what are we missing? And are there fewer traditional intelligence investigations running down real leads? And what have been the economic trade-offs? By early August 2013, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation had published a brief outlining potential impacts to the U.S. cloud computing industry. Out of a global enterprise cloud computing market of $207 billion, IDIF suggests that by 2016, U.S. cloud providers could stand to lose $35 billion. Technology commentator James Staton analyzed the ITEF efforts and found them excellent, but perhaps underplaying the impact, suggesting that the loss could be as great as $180 billion, or a 25% hit to overall IT service provider revenues in the same time frame. Still others are trying to take the pulse of broader consumer concerns, with one outlet reporting in mid-August 2013 that only 7 weeks of post-Snowden media coverage had the percentage of internet users reporting concerns about their privacy online jump from 48 to 67%. Where do we go from here? More recently, I've seen some take the view that privacy is less dead than a victim of circumstance, run over by the unstoppable train of data use and collection that is riding the rails of humanity's hunger for information and the need to know more. The gotta-have-it view seems too dystopian a rationale for the much-needed revisiting of key privacy compliance concepts such as the nature and quality of consent and a more dynamic view of when it's required. We need to give the advance of big data and all of its potential benefits, and certainly the consumer, far more credit. Only 5 years ago, I remember briefing a member of the UK Parliament on the Internet of Things, who, though very tech-savvy, drolly remarked that, if my refrigerator could tweet, I'm not sure that I would want to see what it said. In 5 years, we've come a long way. In a speech at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, Commissioner Julie Brill of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission highlighted that just some of the many ways in which the cloud, big data, and analytics are beginning to change our lives in profound and beneficial ways. By addressing important societal issues like keeping kids in school, conserving our national resources by making our use of electricity more efficient, providing first responders in crisis situations with real-time information about the injured or those who lack power, water, or food, and performing other miracles in the healthcare sector. Indeed, the opportunities for big data analytics may provide in the field of medicine some staggering results. I agree with Daniel Weitzner, former Deputy White House Chief Technology Officer for Internet Policy and now Director of the MIT CSAIL, Decentralized Information Group, who recently noted in an interview that there is a tendency in the U.S. to believe that you can only have privacy if you have secrecy. That if a third party holds your information, then somehow you've lost all your privacy. This is in part an outgrowth of the 1967 decision of the Supreme Court in Katz v. U.S. In Katz, John Marshall Harlan's concurring opinion established the reasonable expectation of privacy test, which contains a subjective component, the actual expectation of privacy, and an objective component, the reasonable expectation of privacy. It was the objective element that has had the unfortunate distinction of evolving into what has become known as the third-party doctrine in the U.S., by which one diminishes or even loses an expectation of privacy through voluntary turnover of data to a third party. Increasingly, it is the quality of voluntarism that is the key component of the doctrine. As Mr. Weitzer notes, protecting privacy in the digital age means creating rules that require governments and businesses to be transparent about how they use our information. This is likely the most important way in which our address of privacy must evolve. Transparency needs to be concise, meaningful, and useful. And while the need for a clear checkbox of consent is, for lawyers, a holy grail on both Atlantic coasts, consumers and their choices far too often fall down the rabbit hole of interminable language as they pull the lever saying, "I agree." This treads upon the notion of what is or isn't truly voluntary under the Katz line of cases and its progeny. I am in full agreement that it is time in the U.S. for adoption of baseline privacy legislation. As Commissioner Brill has said, to close the gaps in consumer privacy protections and help level the playing field among businesses. A key new component, or companion legislation, as the Commissioner highlighted, should require data brokers to provide notice, access, and correction rights to consumers scaled to the sensitivity and use of data at issue. This is an area where Mr. Weitzner also seems to be in agreement. He, in his interview, envisions a world where big databases are audited to prevent abuse, including those of the NSA, and where encryption technology ensures that research involving troves of sensitive personal information don't open windows in individual personal lives. The drive for overarching privacy legislation in the U.S. to supplant or supplement the sector-by-sector approach of our present rules is in no small measure an outgrowth of the current debate over surveillance measures. We don't have to pass judgment on revelations about the NSA to know that these have not only spurred an overdue debate, but also may already be altering the way we think about communication technologies in ways that may take many years to fully realize or understand. For these reasons, I applaud President Obama for welcoming the debate that has developed in the wake of surveillance revelations and his January 17, 2014 speech at the Department of Justice calling for reforms. Congress is considering but not yet passed legislation to recommend an end to the NSA's bulk phone metadata collection program in favor of commercial retention of that same data for an 18-month period. This is a duration that most telecommunications providers already retain, and it is expected that the NSA would be required to produce a court order to access it. I also applaud the president for calling for a national conversation about big data sets, because the conversation must not be restricted to government entities. In this regard, I was pleased that Commissioner Brill noted in her speech that leaders within the business community have joined the president in recognizing that rebuilding the trust of individuals is essential to the success of all programs and services, both governmental and commercial, built on big data analytics. These business leaders have urged companies to adopt enhanced privacy protections as a key part of strengthening consumer trust. This is not, however, an area of trust where the U.S. stands alone, with much work to do. I was not at all surprised by Christopher Wolff's revelation in a March 2014 article that European Parliament Rapporteur Jan Philipp Albrecht is also wary of EU member state surveillance tactics. The draft European Parliament report on mass surveillance had contained a directive specifically that the UK, France, Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands, and Poland should clarify the allegations of mass surveillance and their compatibility with EU laws. Several privacy experts in the US have also argued effectively that the US is not alone in terms of its surveillance modes and methods. Though the everybody's doing it and our law is better arguments from the US on these issues may not be dispositive of big problems, they certainly have provided a helpful perspective and hopefully tempered some hyperbole. The real danger of surveillance in a state is a person or persons who believes that the broadening of authorized surveillance actions is always morally justified and prudent. It is someone who, perhaps with the best of intentions, can make the most grievous of mistakes with eyes wide open and believe that the ends do justify the means. The maintenance of dignity through privacy is ultimately about defining one's autonomy within a society. It is the boundary between the individual and the society. The fact that Adam and Eve were aware of their nakedness and ashamed by it is, in the Christian sense, cited as a byproduct of their original sin. But in a larger sense, their defenses to shame arose from recognition of power, in this example, God's power, and the feeling of smallness in recognition of it, the vastness of their environs and what they did or didn't know. Circumstances had suddenly made them self-aware in a brave new world. Sound familiar? I agree with those taking an extreme view on the death of privacy to the extent that the innovation of the digital age and all that it will do to change and enhance our lives will alter forever how we think about communities and the maintenance of standards. It must. The promise of the digital age and its improvement of society on so many levels has not, however, also metaphorically erased the requisite for dignity. Not even the internet is that creatively destructive. The question of whether and under what circumstances we champion privacy, as a right, as a freedom to be left alone, a concept embodied in an overarching omnibus law, or as merely a protection that we want afforded by the court in response to a harm, raises much larger issues of what kind of society we want to be and how we prioritize our freedoms versus our restrictions. If we truly believe that privacy is lost, then a key component of what makes us human is as well. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 40 AM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from Your Active, The Washington Post, National Public Radio, The Information Law Group, Business Insider, Circle ID, and the BBC. Thank you for listening. 40 AM in 5 will be back with you again on Monday, August 4th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.